Six music.
BBC Radio. Six music documentaries.
David Byrne was the first person who I interviewed using just questions about the important firsts in his life. His varied career made him the ideal subject matter, and the interview went so well it gave him the idea of basing a whole show around it. We met in London as he prepared for his tour performing tracks from his back catalogue with Brian Eno, and at the time we broadcast a chunk of the interview here on Six. But he talked for so long that it just made sense to include him in the series that he helped inspire. There's few musicians who pursued a career path as interesting as David Byrne. His first band, Talking Heads, emerged from New York's post-punk scene to encompass art rock, funk and the avant-garde before he went solo, helping pioneer ambient music with Brian Eno, embracing world music as a record company boss and writing for operas and film soundtracks. He's a respected photographer, designer and author and continues to collaborate with everyone from Fatboy Slim to the Dirty Projectors. He's just David Byrne.
Hey!
I started by asking him about his first recollections of music as a child.
Oh, I'd heard music as a child, but it was the things my parents would play, which were either Mozart or Gene Redpath. I didn't really take that strongly to either of those. I still don't like Mozart. What else do I remember? Then, of course, I'd look those little kiddie records, the colored ones, and then watch them spin around. But I remember, I remember having a transistor radio, one of those little radios, and hearing, I think, Mr. Tambourine Man by the Byrds, and thinking, that's a sound I've never heard before, and the words, I don't know what that's about either. And I thought, there's something going on out there, and it seemed to be speaking more to me than to my parents' generation.
What was the first piece of music you actually owned?
Probably not too many years after that, I think I went and bought some 45s. I think I got a Beatles single and a Rolling Stones single. And then after that, I think I maybe got some James Brown records and some Temptations records and that sort of thing.
At what point did you kind of ally those singles with, this is something I'd like to be creating in some form?
Oh, pretty early on, I think. I didn't think of it as a serious career option, but I think at that time in school, in high school, in suburban Baltimore, everybody that could manage was either picking up a guitar or banging on something and pretending it was a drum kit and trying to be in a band and learn the riff from Satisfaction or something like that. I wasn't a singer, I was a guitar player in a high school group. And yeah, it was just something that you did. It wasn't like that this was going to be your career. You weren't like going for stardom. It was just like, this is a cool thing to do.
What was the first song you performed then, if you say there was these groups cropping up? Can you remember the first time you actually took to the stage and played something?
I remember with that band, I think it was the songs that were easy to play at that time. We might have done You Really Got Me, something like that. We might have done a song by, I think, Paul Revere and the Raiders.
tricks that you used on me. You're reading all them high fashion magazines. The clothes you're wearing lately causing public scenes. I said, I'm not your stepping stone. No! No, I'm not your stepping stone. Your front page news. You've been awful careful about the friends you choose, but you won't find my name in your book of who's who. Said I'm not your stepping stone. Not me, no. I said I'm not your stepping stone. No. Not your stepping stone.
I think it might have been the first, maybe the only time we played in, there was a battle of the bands in the school cafeteria, and one of the friends of one of the competing bands snuck behind us and pulled our plugs out in the middle of the show, so that was not a real good start.
What was the band called?
I forget what it was called. Shortly after that, when I was in art school, I hooked up with a friend and had a kind of, I guess you'd call it busking. I played ukulele and violin. I had violin lessons as a child, and he played accordion, and we did a mixture of old standards and a few kind of contemporary songs.
Was it about that time you started writing songs yourself?
I tried, and no, it didn't work. I tried writing.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Didn't work. I could tell it was terrible.
What was the first song that you wrote that you were pleased with, that you thought, okay, this is what I'm hearing now is close to what I intended it to sound like?
At some point, I guess I was in art school, or had just dropped out of art school, and I wrote Psycho Killer mainly as an exercise to try once again and see if I could write a song. And I was satisfied and thought, yeah, that sounds like a song. And then, from my point of view, I never followed up on that. I thought, okay, that proves to me that I could do it. But then everything I wrote after that, I thought, that was kind of an exercise, that particular song. But it wasn't really me writing. It wasn't really, that's not the direction I want to go in. So I feel like I changed. Everything else I wrote after that was a little bit more, well, not really serious, but more, I felt like, I've proved to myself that I can write songs, I'm going to write songs that are more what I want to write.
More you.
Yeah, more you. More me. Or me in the sense of creatively, which the direction I want to go in. But of course, yeah, the one that was written as just as a test to see if I could write became instantly very popular. It was nice that it was popular, but it was also kind of strange.
As we're going through these firsts, what was the first time? Actually, the first time you played with Talking Heads, the first time you performed together, what can you remember about that?
We auditioned at CBGB's. We'd lived around the corner, just off the Bowery, which was a pretty rundown neighborhood then. And Hilly, their owner, would have auditions in the late afternoons or something, and we came in, auditioned, and I don't know if it was Hilly or maybe Lenny Kaye Petty Smith's guitar player who was there, who said, they've got something. And Hilly put us on as the opening slot for the Ramones, which we thought was great. I think we'd seen them perform there. And we'd seen them and Patti Smith and Television were already performing there.
What was the first time you met Eno like? Did you instantly hit it off as people?
We did hit it off pretty, more or less instantly. John Cale, who used to be in Velvet Underground, brought Brian to see us at a little club in Covent Garden, where we played in, I guess it was 76. We were there again, touring with the Ramones, but we had one show of our own at a little club in Covent Garden. This is before we had a record out. I think we had a single out. And so that he came, we got along well and kept in touch. We didn't instantly say, oh, please produce our next record. We just kept in touch and stayed friends.
What's he like? Because he's kind of, his reputation, in the UK at least, is of this kind of a blend of being this massively cerebral character, but also artistically enormously free, which are two things that maybe don't normally go together, I think. At least in music, you don't normally get someone who's an intellectual, but also kind of an aesthete at the same time.
Yeah, and he's very funny. Kind of very charming and funny. A really good talker. I'm envious of how well he talks. I mean, well, in conversation, but also kind of public speaking, talking in front of people. He's very charming and involving when he does that, whereas I think I kind of stumble and lose my way.
We'll be right back.
What was the first work you did for a soundtrack? Because you've done an awful lot of soundtrack work, either film or theatre. What was the first piece you kind of wrote that was intended for that, that world?
Oh, I think it might have been the Catherine Wheel, which was maybe, which was, I think, in 1980 or so, 80, 81, somewhere around there. It was for a dance theater piece that a choreographer named Twyla Tharp was doing. And around that time, we were doing Bush of Ghosts record and Remain in Light. So it was a record that was done very much in that mold of kind of put the things together in the studio and invite a lot of collaborators in and see what happens.
Had you always intended to work in formats outside the kind of band and solo artist constraints in terms of theatre and things like that? Had that always been on your agenda?
No, there was no agenda. You just get an invitation and you go, that sounds like a really cool thing to do. But, I mean, I was aware that musicians in the past that I respected and admired had done things like that, had done movie scores or instrumental records or kind of side projects, some of which maybe weren't very commercially successful, but were...
Which kind of people?
Let's see. I was aware of, like, all the funny side projects that, say, early on, like in the late 60s, that the Beatles and the Rolling Stones had done, like recording the whatever, Pipes of Pan and Jujuka, or I think George Harrison did an electronic record...
You're listening to The First Time with David Byrne.
Six Music.
BBC Six Music.
Imagine there's a God. Imagine I'm a devil. Imagine I'm a saint. Lazy money, lazy sexy, lazy out of space. No tears are falling from my eyes. I'm keeping all the pain inside. Now don't you wanna live with me? I'm lazy as a man can be. I'm wicked and I'm lazy. Oh, don't you wanna save me? Lazy when I work, lazy all the day. Screaming all you like, but it only fades away. I'm lazy when I'm praying, lazy on the job. Got a lazy mind, a lazy eye, a lazy, lazy body. Hard men, hard lives. Stop.
I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time with David Byrne. As someone who's always absorbed an eclectic range of influences, I asked him how his interest in dance music began.
With Talking Heads, our record collection was pretty much split down the middle between kind of art rock and whatever the club music was at the time. So there'd be kind of a Roxy Music or an Iggy Pop record, and then next to that was James Brown, Hamilton Bohannon, and whatever, OJs, which was what was being played in the dance clubs at the time. And then occasionally, just around that time, you started to get 12-inch mixes and DJ mixes and that sort of thing. It started to happen just after that. It was, and that seemed really great as well. I guess it was late 70s, early 80s, you started getting that, and you started getting these really what seemed to us a really kind of creative take on dance music or club music that seemed to be at least as creative, sometimes more so, than the kind of art rock or rock music that was going on in a parallel universe that never met. There was really no overlap whatsoever, which seemed like a great shame. We all loved both kinds of music and tried to in some ways integrate elements of both into what we were doing, so it seems sort of natural when many, many years down the line, when those guys said, we've got a track that we think might be suitable for you to write a vocal over, I said, yeah, I know how to do this. Yeah. The original track, God, I wish I had it. I probably have it somewhere on a computer or something. Didn't sound anything like the finished record. I seem to remember the original Lazy track that had a feel that was a little more like our song, Life During Wartime. It had a bit more of a kind of house version of that. And I thought, that's why they sent it to me. It reminded them of that song, so they thought, let's send this to David Byrne and see.
Bye.
another first. What was the first... Can you remember what the first track was that you played on David Byrne Radio? Because I love going to the site, your website, and seeing these track listings, and now, of course, you can download them, and you can... It's you know, quite ahead of your time with the playlists, I suppose, the people that sort of arrive on Spotify and stuff. You were doing your own playlists for the public. Can you remember? Because I've got them here. Can you remember what the
you
first... I know what the first one was, I think.
It's been a few years since I've been doing that, and you'd have thought that I'd have run out of... tracks on my computer or CDs or whatever, but there's still a lot of great stuff that I kind of can make a month-long theme out of. Oh, anyways, yeah, so that's what I do. Every month I put about 3 hours worth of music to be streamed, that can be streamed on my website of either a particular genre or something from a particular country or just sometimes things that I've heard in the last couple of months that I've collected my favorite songs from new releases or whatever. And it's great. It's the same impulse that I had when I started the record label many, many years ago. But now you don't have to really go license the songs or deal with those pesky artists. You can just offer up to the public the stuff that you're hearing that you're liking.
I believe it was California Stars by Wilco and Billy Bragg.
That was the first one?
Either that or Neighborhood Number One by Arcade Fire. I'm not quite sure whether you start at the top of the list or the bottom of the list.
Yeah, I don't know either. Oh, so then it was probably a list of just a hodgepodge of things that were on my iPod at the time.
Forward to the present day. When did you first get the idea to do the tour based around the work of you and Mr. Eno?
Well, I guess it was in the spring, last spring, a year ago. I could see that we were actually going to have enough songs for a record and that it was nearing completion in the next month or so back then. And I really was enjoying singing the songs. I listen to my own music or music I'm collaborating on a lot when I'm working on it in I found it really enjoyable. After I finished something, I'd put it away and never listen to it again, but except if I'm performing it. So I thought, I'm really enjoying this, and it would be a shame to never ever get to sing it again, except for the one time when the recording microphone is in front of me. So I thought, I'd like to, and it does sound like it could be performed. It's not music that's completely unperformable. So I said, yeah, I'm going to start accepting some tour dates in the late summer, early fall. And so that'll put a kind of a fire under us to finish things up, and it'll give me a deadline that I've got to get a tour together and some kind of show together. At first, as we artists sometimes do, my first impulse was, I'm only going to do the new stuff. I'm not going to do anything old at all. And then, I guess wiser minds prevailed and said, your audience is going to be really annoyed if you only do the new record. My argument, I didn't stick with that. But I thought, okay, well, how can I don't want to just do a hodgepodge of stuff, but I realized, I could thematically bring in some stuff that the audience would like to hear by using Eno as a connection. So that's what I did. And then, so that kind of opened it up to some older stuff and newer stuff and seeing whether there was any threads between the two. And then I thought, there needs to be something besides just us standing there performing, playing, singing. I think we need to have more reason for people to spend money, get out of their houses and go down to the venue than just to hear music with people standing there playing it. I thought that's all well and good in a club where it's more intimate and you see the kind of intimate interplay of the musicians and the looks on their faces and all that kind of smaller things at work. But on larger venues, I thought we need something. And I thought, video is something that is done fairly regularly now, but I've seen other people's shows that have used video, such as, I think it might have been Super Furry Animals that I saw a show in New York where the video was so in sync with the songs.
Sounds like them.
Every song had a different kind of video thing going on, and it was totally in sync with the songs. How are they doing this? This is so... They have worked on this and focused on this, and I thought, I'll never catch up to this. I can't do video. But I thought, well, hot dancers. No one would expect me to have dancers. And the first thought when I say I've got dancers is going to be, you're kidding. Have you lost your mind? And there are people will think it's either a gag and it's like go-go dancers, or that it's kind of, you know, a Janet Jackson, Madonna type thing.
You'd be fantastic with Janet Jackson style Madonna dancers. That would be brilliant. first on the list next?
Two easy ones. There's a project, kind of a sound installation thing that I did in New York called Playing the Building, that was a thing that where the public comes in and kind of sits at an old keyboard and activates these machines that are strapped to bits of an old building. So that's going to go to the Roundhouse here in London. It'll be up for a month. And the Roundhouse is perfect. They'll just strip everything out and open the windows along the top, which there are windows and kind of skylights all along the top that are never opened up because it would interfere with performances and things in there. But it's beautiful when the light streams in. And so it's the perfect place for it. And so that looks like that's going to happen. And I'm going to finally finish this project, at least the record, with Norman Cook, the Imelda project, Here Lies Love. I've got one or two or three more singers to record on it. So rather than doing it first as a theatrical thing, that's proved to be too many possibilities of going astray. I thought, let's do the record. We know how to do records. Let's do that first, and then we can kind of do that and say, this is the way we hear the music. Here's the songs, and then see where it goes. So it'll be whatever, two CDs or whatever format exists a year from now.
And who's on that record? Who else is collaborating? Can you remember?
Oh, loads. it's a different singer on every song. So Sharon Jones is on one, and Santo Gold is on one, and Roisin Murphy, and yesterday Alice Russell sang a song, and Tori Amos, and goes on and on. It's a lot of singers.
And after all these firsts, and the first this and the first that, let's finish off with, what's the last thing we should play?
Oh, I just did a collaboration with a group called the Dirty Projectors, and it's on this record called Dark as the Night, which is a kind of a AIDS charity record, and that was a fun collaboration. And yeah, so that's probably the newest thing that I've got that's out.
It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.